Hi again, Austin Wintory here. This time I am chatting with yet another composer. His name is Gareth Coker. He is why you love Ori and the Blind Forest. He's a good part of why you probably cried at the beginning of that game. We talk quite a lot about not just Ori. We talk about ModDB, a site that has gotten more love on this podcast than I think any other in the history of game podcasts. We talk about teaching English in Japan and other novel slash universal experiences. And on it goes. It was approximately 5 hours of recording, so we hope you enjoy it.
Welcome to the Game Maker's Notebook, a podcast featuring a series of in-depth one-on-one conversations between game makers providing a thoughtful, intimate perspective on the business and craft of interactive entertainment. The Game Maker's Notebook is presented by the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences, a member-driven organization dedicated to the recognition and advancement of interactive entertainment.
Hello, Gareth.
Hi, Austin.
How are you?
I'm pretty good. I'm glad we're through the... This is like 2 days before E3, and I think both of us are through the crunch period and getting everything done for E3. So I'm like, this week has been a quieter week, relatively speaking.
You look pale and sickly, which means the crunch has just passed.
I mean,
or you're British.
It's probably the latter.
Yeah. Understood. Well, there's a lot that I am excited to get into, but it seems it's customary to give us just kind of a little bit of a background. In particular, I think you and I have a similar arc where we worked for a long time in total anonymity, and then, you know, one particular project seemed to kind of overnight change that. And so give us the pre-Ori anonymous Gareth snapshot.
So I arrived in America in 2009, did the USC film scoring program, the same one you did, I think. Mm-hmm. And then after that program, it's like you're out in the real world.
Yep, exactly.
I did do a little bit of interning and assisting during that program. And long story short, I figured out that I wasn't a very good intern or assistant. I worked better for myself rather than other people. So then I was like, well, I'm going to have to figure this out pretty quick, because if there's one thing about living in Los Angeles, it gets expensive really quickly when you're not earning.
Out of curiosity, actually, you hit on something that I'm curious, because I relate to it, but I want to know more about to what extent.
Yeah.
What made you a bad assistant?
I think
we're just going to ruin all future employment prospects in this sector right here.
I think it was partially an age thing. I was like 26, and I was like, man, it's going to be like 3 to 4 years before I feel like I get to do anything actually musical at this place. Maybe that wouldn't have been the case, and probably that was a poor attitude to have, but that was my attitude at the time.
Right.
I think if I'd been 22, I'd have been like, well, whatever. I'll just do whatever. I'll go and do whatever this person says because I don't know any better.
Yeah.
But it was like on a knife's edge. It's like, was I going to go it alone? Or was I going to help someone else? I chose to go it alone. As for what made me a bad assistant, partially like a lack of patience. I think I just wasn't that engaged with the work I was doing.
Was it like intern, you know, get the coffee kind of stuff?
Get the coffee. I think the most memorable thing that I can remember doing was taking CDs from this person's library of CDs and importing them into iTunes. It was literally like a stack of 1,000 CDs. And I was like, I'm not sure I want to do this. And, you know, who knows? It could have led somewhere great, because, I mean, the composer in question was very, very A-list. But I just made the decision to go by myself.
Well, if it makes you feel better, you had a little bit of technological foresight, because I don't think any interns are doing that job anymore. I think CD importing is kind of a museum
Spotify
job.
Spotify has removed that job. Yeah. I think Spotify and YouTube.
Yep.
And I think the other thing is like, also, I mean, I was commuting an hour and 15 minutes for that. I was like, this just isn't worth my time or the expense, I'll take the risk and go it alone.
How soon after USC were you at that crossroad?
I had one internship like during USC that lasted like 3 to 4 weeks. And then I had one that was like two months immediately after finishing the USC program. Then I left that basically in the July after graduating. So it was basically 2 months after graduating.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So
this was a decision. It's funny because I actually, when talking to students, something I tell them that I didn't realize how well you exemplify is, because of the freelance nature of this work, if you don't love it in general or some aspect, you get that feedback immediately. Yep. And I'm always saying to them, that's a feature, not a bug. If you're not cut out for something specific, just emotionally or whatever, socially or whatever the metric is, the industry, the kind of your happiness level will tell you pretty instantaneously. You don't have to draw paychecks twice a week for 10 years and then look back and go, oh my God, I'm so fucking unhappy.
Yeah. I mean, like with the figuring out of like my approach to assisting, I've told other composers who are getting into the business, like, look, there's nothing wrong with assisting, but you have to love it. Like you have to want to do it. Otherwise, what's the point?
Yeah.
And if you do love it, then it can probably be a great thing for you. But like, if you speak to any composer, we all kind of like have slightly different paths into the industry. It's
absolutely.
So, but yeah, like it's a lot of it is about attitude and happiness.
Yeah. And probably also your resonance with whoever you're assisting. Mm-hmm. It's very personal. It's almost like it's not, corporate in the sense of kind of rotate any assistant through in an ideal world, you're investing in that relationship as if it was any other client, basically a director or a game designer or something like that. Well, so we have sort of two different chapters. I want to look at both. There's the post USC slash post assistant decision, but pre Ori, but also just prior to that, give me a sense of like, how did you even decide to go to USC to begin with? You know, kind of the childhood exposure to music, all that sort of thing.
So
just a little glimpse of
the Gareth life.
Tiny.
History.
Yeah. Tiny Gareth.
So my parents moved around a lot when I was young, but they always wanted me to go to an English school. So like from the age of,
moved a lot within the UK
like abroad. Like
actually you lived in Japan at one point, didn't you?
That's I'll get to that.
Okay. Spoilers.
From the age of 8, my parents sent me to boarding school. Now boarding school in America is like, it's funny whenever I say to Americans like, oh, I went to boarding school. They're like, oh, were you a bad child?
I'm picturing you in a Catholic schoolgirl outfit.
I'm afraid not. In England, like it's been standard for, you know, centuries. And they wanted me to have an English education. We were living in the Netherlands and on the East Coast of America because my dad's job. So
they are themselves English.
Yes.
So
It was just my dad was asked to move to a different location, and I guess he got a big enough salary bump that it was worth it. So
right.
But I carried on going to English school, and at boarding school, there's not a lot to do. And my parents bought me piano lessons.
For all the like Animal House style shenanigans that one dreams about.
But you do that for like a week and then it's like, well, what else is there?
I have to live with these people.
Right.
Fair enough.
So I got piano lessons also at the age of 8. And I was kind of into it. But then at boarding school, I was like, well, there's literally nothing else to do. So I'm just going to practice. Because it was like an escape. And, you know, when you're that age and you practice a lot, you get pretty good. That's just what happens as long as you practice properly. But like, that's what I did. I got really into music in boarding school and was playing in band, was singing in choir, was in orchestra, big band. Like I signed up for everything. I didn't really get into writing music until I was 16. And even then I wasn't really serious about it. It really came from my improvisation skills developed in jazz band. I was like, hey, this is pretty fun. I, you know, just end up jamming over the same chord sequence for hours and hours and hours.
Yeah, we've all done it.
Yep. How many times have you added a blues scale to like
I think I did
any
that,
of
I
your
think,
chord sequences?
I think I did that just 10 minutes ago. Yeah.
Right.
It's one of the beautiful art forms that you learn to play things wrong and discover something interesting along the way, basically.
So then,
I'm curious to, because it's funny, you represent it in this very blasé, like, well, you know, because some people, there's a lot of classic tropes as to how composers got into it. You know, there's the old fashioned like rock and roll. I did it for the women. You know, there's still lurking around. There's those kinds who were trying to impress somebody, basically. And then there's others that it really is, you know, just this obsession they're fanatic about, or it's like the parents who just force it by sheer will onto you. And you're kind of like, what else was I going to do?
So that was the case at the beginning with the composing part of it, which came from the improvisation. I found that I really enjoyed improvisation.
So that's the spark.
Because it was an escape. Like, I can do whatever I want and no one can really stop me right now.
Yeah.
Like, as long as, you know, I'd be appropriate. But then from playing in a band, that would also develop onto just jamming on the piano by myself. Instead of being limited by sheet music, I was like, well, I can do whatever I want, because your harmonic vocabulary increases exponentially when you're playing, like, especially in jazz, jazz music. And I'd end up just out of nothing, just starting doing melodies over chord sequences. And then one of my teachers basically overheard like what I was doing. He's like, well, you should apply to music school. And I was like, I don't know how to write for orchestra. I don't know how to do anything. It's like, and I will help you with that. Like, so my portfolio.
And at what age was this then?
This is like 16. Uh-huh. So you have to apply at the age of 17. So it's like a crash course for a year, mm-hmm. pretty much. And my portfolio, I went to the Royal Academy of Music. My portfolio for that was like 66% piano, and then there was like a random string quartet thing, which my music teacher at the time, he played all of the parts on it for me, like in his free time, which was very nice of him.
What a kind of little preview of the future of production.
I had no idea at the time. And then the rest was just some like random, awful electronic orchestra synth thing.
Now, how'd you wrangle that? If you were kind of a neophyte to it, is that like a finale playback?
There's a facility at school. They just built a new music classroom at the school, which had like a bunch of basic playback for orchestral instruments in some sense. It was very rudimentary compared to what we're using now.
Sure. But you must have that had to be rolled into the crash course then, right?
Yes,
like sequencing and mock-ups and that sort of stuff. Did you know that that is a skill unto itself that would be of value, or for you it was just a means to the end to produce this portfolio?
It was a means to the end to produce the portfolio, but actually I was like, because I was really into video games forever, and I was really into technology. So the fact that the technology was helping me create all of this stuff, I was able to, like, that's actually like really helped me develop the palette and like expand the knowledge that you need to like get started.
I guess also music. Being a gamer, you probably never actually thought about this before, but it'd be an interesting question for other composers who grew up, you know, we're about the same age. We grew up probably with listening to a lot of similar sort of scores. And I think gamers pound for pound are far more approving or accepting of sampled orchestras because that's all we got for the first 20 years, basically. Yep.
Especially people our age, I think, because I think we're the same age.
35.
The development of game music since when we were starting playing games to what it is now. I mean, it is the full spectrum. It's gone from mono to Atmos in our lifetime.
Yeah, that's exactly.
So,
and not even mono, like mono within a very, very restricted. It's not
mono,
like,
and restricted sound sources.
Yeah, exactly. And where, you know, it was the equivalent of composing with punch cards. that I think is interesting, because I don't think people of that who kind of came of age as gamers in the early and mid 90s or even late 80s, but particularly once the kind of soft synth fake orchestra thing started to pull away, like 16-bit sound started to kind of distinguish itself from 8-bit sound. There was just a blanket acceptance of like, that weird sort of pipe organ thing is strings, and that other pipe organ thing is woodwinds. So I feel like, people like us, those early mock-ups that we would do probably weren't as offensive as they should be.
Right.
Because to a film buff or aspiring film composer, it just sounds heinously cheap and horrible.
Right.
Like, they don't see it as its own sound.
Well, that segues nicely into like what they actually said to me at the portfolio. They were like, you know, you don't really have much orchestral chops. You know, there's a lot of stuff you don't know, but the one thing you do know how to do is you know how to write a tune, and that's like why I got accepted. Like,
really?
Because they were like, the rest of the stuff we can pretty easily teach you, but like the melody writing thing was like the thing that they. It was based that year, at least, it's what they were looking for. So
it's very unusual for any academic institution to value that.
Well, that's the thing. So
maybe they're more sort of progressive there than I realized.
So there's at the time I was there, there was the composition course, which is what you are probably thinking of, and they also had a course called Media and Applied Music. Now those two are together in the same program, so you'd have to do like, you know, you'd have to do all of the crazy 20th century stuff. But no, the Media and Applied Music program was explicitly for the kind of music that we are writing in general. So
it's probably worth a little disclaimer for the non-composer nerd community listeners of this to kind of get what we're talking about, because the short version is that the history of music education for the last 50 years has been kind of the last bastion of those various forms of classical music that audiences universally hate. All the hyper dissonant, atonal, you know, kind of procedurally generated, as it were, this, you know, sequence music or 12 tone music, all that kind of thing is the only place that really lives now. And so the idea of a university professor saying, wow, you can really write a good tune, that would normally be a chastisement.
Yes.
Under most, they would,
yes,
look at you and go, who do you think you are? You know, that era has come and gone. Like, yeah, thanks, Brahms.
Yeah.
Get the hell out of here. So that's really, really cool and atypical, and also good kind of foresight on their part, because I would definitely say it's a distinguishing characteristic of your writing now. Is that come from, to the extent that you can self-analyze and sort of figure out where a tunefulness would come from in your own writing? Is it just based on the kind of stuff you grew up listening to?
Or? I think again, to go back to the jazz band thing, I mean, the right hand is almost always leading with melodic, with lines, and then the left hand is almost always doing harmony. Now, obviously, that's a very crude way of breaking down jazz improvisation, but at least that's where most people start.
Yeah, it's not wrong.
And I think
pretty hard to improvise, like,
right,
fugues and
exactly. And I think that's where, you know, the improvisation, you know, when it stopped being jazz, I was like, I'm just writing tunes. I'm just harmony left hand, melody right hand. But I think I've also always been into tuneful music. I've always liked soundtracks and music in general that lead with a strong melody. I'm either one or the other. It either has to be like the most crazy texture, and a texture can be an identity in itself.
Oh, yeah,
or it,
sure,
has to be melodically led, and anything that's kind of waffling, that's in between, I don't really like. I'm like, can you just decide what you want to do? Do you want to present the melody, or do you want to present this crazy texture? But that, I mean, that's just me.
Yeah, no, I'm with you on that.
So yeah, I mean, and it's the way I write too. I usually try and find a line and then build around it. It's rare that I start with a chord sequence. I usually, because once I have the line, you can put any old chord sequence underneath it with enough work. So,
well, plus I you know, I'm often accused of being kind of retrogressive, I guess, in this, or regressive, because I'm the same way. I think the audience, the listener, whether it's a, you know, a gamer who's hearing your work incidental to playing the game, or it's someone listening to a CD or whatever, you know, before importing it into their boss's iTunes. And I will update my sentence to say listening on Spotify. They will follow you down any rabbit hole as long as there's something for them to hang on to. And like, we're built as singing. Our inborn musical instrument is the monophonic human,
yep,
voice. So,
yep,
like, to me, it seems kind of obvious that melody would be by far the easiest thing for someone to track through,
right,
all kinds of crazy roller coasters. And so,
yep,
it's like, you sound like this 19th century romantic to say, you know, melody really counts. But it's like, go to any Hollywood Bowl, you know,
yep,
the best film scores of all time.
It's,
are any of
melody,
them like texture studies? And
right.
I mean, it's pretty rare.
Yep.
Planet of the Apes is probably the only score ever that seems to consistently land on those kinds of lists that is essentially totally devoid of melody.
Yep.
But otherwise, yeah, it's all about the hook.
The hook.
Like, has pop music taught us nothing? That's such a big thing. I don't understand the departure of that. So yeah, I'm with you on there.
That's another brilliant segue, by the way, because you mentioned the hook, and you mentioned pre Ori Invisible Gareth.
Yeah.
So the reason I'm interested about hooks is because I worked in trailer music, pretty much. Almost exclusively, as well as doing some smaller games before Ori came out. But like, trailer music is what paid my bills.
Yeah.
Before.
Now, how'd you get into that?
I had a friend who was at boarding school who worked at a trailer editing company, and they needed music. So
you're always my favorite go-to of like just someone who goes out into the world and opportunities, if you can see them in front of you. Because we'll get to Ori in a moment. It's my favorite story of that nature that probably ever. But I didn't. This is the first time. So childhood boarding school, you mean? Like,
yeah. So we were friends in boarding school, and then you know we went our separate ways because obviously he didn't go to music school. But yeah, he was working at a trailer edit house, and they needed music
in the UK.
In the UK, yes, and they needed music. And they weren't doing it through like the classic, you know, we'll just pick a song from a catalog. They wanted something custom. And I'm like, okay, well, what is this? And it was just some drums, just like some Korean action film that was being distributed in the UK. but I did that one, and then it led to more. And then that trailer company had an office in America. And so the cool thing about it is that I was basically working with the trailer people who were cutting the trailer directly. There was no middleman.
Oh, wow. That's unusual.
So the license was, yes, it is very unusual. Now, these weren't for like the massive trailers. These are for like independent films. But that's the thing. There's like a whole market. Everyone sees all these massive trailers with the same big
Two Steps
epic
from
music.
Hell. And yeah.
But there's a whole market underneath there. And that, like, honestly, I think that probably saved me for like from going bankrupt, like for those like 4 to 5 years. Because they would come in like, you know, 2 to 3 every month. And it's a 2-minute piece of music.
Right. Of course, like, typically 2 minutes, but with 40 trillion revisions.
Nah, usually only 3 or 4.
Oh, well, lucky
because,
you.
Because they were cutting to the...
That's why.
They were either cutting to music, or it was a case of rip off the temp, which they'd already cut to. But they often, there was one specific case, they were like, yeah, we can't afford to license this Led Zeppelin track. And I'm like, yeah, I bet you can't. So they're like, how close can you get? And I'm like, well, I don't want to get sued. But, you know, we can put a guitar and some drums and we'll just see how it's feel. They wanted the vibe. They didn't need the actual song.
Right.
So I'm just like, let's match the tempo and we'll probably get everything to fall on the right beats and the rest is done. So there's like lots of little jobs throughout the year. So between that... and selling music on royalty-free music websites, which actually I got in just before like everyone was getting in.
Yeah, before the massive market glut.
Right. And yeah, that has added up. I don't do the custom trailer stuff anymore. But between that royalty-free music and I have some live stuff on library music albums too, I was able to have an income and not worry about paying the bills.
Yeah.
Now this is work that like, you know, no one really has ever heard because it just ends up on TV somewhere or in some random theater. But
that's the thing.
You have to survive.
Absolutely. And a lot of people, you know, because we have, you know, there's a few household names, right? John Williams, mm-hmm. Hans Zimmer, Danny Elfman. There's a few folks that, and then, you know, there's the list right below them that a lot of people know.
Yep.
Alan Silvestri, Howard Shore. They're not necessarily... They're not John Williams, but they're not trivial figures. And the game industry has its corollary and television has its corollary. People don't realize that there's still tens of thousands of hours of music being written by a whole giant sort of piranha pool of people other than that. And that especially younger composers getting started don't realize that there is a virtually eternal supply of opportunity if they're willing to go hunting for it.
That is the actual, like, that is so key because, like, you know, when we're all starting, we're like, yeah, I want to work on the biggest film.
Yeah, I want to be John Williams.
Yes, exactly. But, like, how are you going to get there? Like, you know, we all know kind of what the final destination is. I don't know why I'm using my hands when we're on a podcast.
we feel it. We feel the energy, you know?
But like we all know like what we want to.
Robin Williams used his hands when he was tracking the genie, so it's all good.
But it's like once you do get started in the industry, it's like, oh my God, I now have to figure out how I'm going to like try, at least try and get there. And,
well, and they forget that, you know, using John Williams as the example, the endless pile of sort of thankless anonymous stuff that he did long before he was John Williams and not even the Johnny Williams sort of noteworthy jazz musician period too. I mean, it was like Jerry Goldsmith, similarly, he wrote library music for CBS, you know, before he got his own little middling features.
It definitely doesn't happen overnight.
No.
Something my dad always told me is like, just think about, you know, where do you want to be like 5 years from now? And just think about like that, not like 10, 15 years, like break it down into smaller chunks. And that helped me a lot. And funnily enough, it was actually literally 5 years from when I started working full time and then Ori came out. You know, I did have a couple of smaller games came out. One was called Primal Carnage, which was actually great because even though I didn't get paid up front on that, there was back end on that, which like, again, helped pay the bills. In fact, I'm still getting checks for Primal Carnage today, which is just kind of amazing because it really was, you know, put together in people's bedrooms and was
it
a very, very indie team. But all the time, not all the time, but basically from like 2012, you know, I'd started working on Ori, but I had to keep quiet about it because it was pretty much developed in secret for quite a long time.
Right. So yeah, that's that. Well, why don't we use that as our pivot then? Because you were grinding along doing this sort of thing, and obviously you had a thought of, you know, I'm surviving, but this was also not the long-term plan.
I don't think I'd have been happy doing that for my whole career.
Yeah.
For sure.
I mean, the only people that there are people that kind of build up so much.
The catalog is massive that it can be sustained.
And they build up a lot of clients where they're able to start kind of hiring composers and they build up sort of like a music company. Mm. And there's certainly some of those out there as well. But I think we're probably similar that like, running admin of a music studio is not the goal. The goal is writing music.
We both got into this to tell stories.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Couldn't put it better than that. Absolutely. Storytelling is at the heart of it all. And so I love the story of how you first encountered the Ori folks. So why don't you give us that? And also actually as preface, it's something peculiar about our corner of the industry is it's not a given that the composer is themselves a gamer. And I've always found that utterly bizarre. But one of the things I immediately liked about you was that you have always been like, you actually speak the language of games through the lens of having played them for essentially your whole life, as I understand it. So what kinds of games framed your thinking on what games could be? I ask specifically because for so many people, Ori is the game that taught them what games could be, like the potential. So I'm just curious what you went into that feeling.
So, I mean, I didn't really zero in on writing games music as a career, like pretty much until I arrived at USC, actually. I really just wanted to write music at first, but I was like...
anything will do.
Yes, anything will do. But then I was like, when I actually sat down and thought about it, I was like, well, I've been playing games since I was 4, and this is the medium I know and understand best. So that would probably be a good place to start. And it's what I do most in my spare time.
Right.
Let's see. I think the first game, and you're going to love this as an answer, the first game which made an impression on me musically were the Star Wars X-Wing and TIE Fighter games.
Oh, nice.
Like with the crazy interactive music system at the time.
Yeah,
like the iMuse system. Like I was talking to Peter McConnell about it.
He's one of my must have on this podcast guys.
We were in Poland last year for the thing that you're later this year. We had a long chat about several things, but like those Star Wars games, those were like one of the first times I noticed music. I was like, huh, that's really interesting. I was too young to really appreciate it, but it did, you know, I remembered that and I was 9 when they came out. Then I think,
and what about just games in general?
Okay.
Irrespective of the
irrespective of music. Okay.
Yeah. But just like what game was just, you know, that diamond experience.
The diamond is Deus Ex.
Ah, yeah.
That was the first game to me that presented player choice.
Right.
And also just the world, like the world building in that game. I mean, so if there's a game I'd love to see get remastered, even though it probably loses a little bit of its charm because it's quite a janky game it's doing so... The fact that that entire game fit on a CD-ROM, like compared with like what, and that game is like 40 hours. There's a lot of gameplay,
huge amount of EO too. There's like 40 billion NPCs that all have stories.
They all have dialogue as well. Yeah. Like the dialogue is like this really low bit rate recording, but they got it all on there somehow. But I think I played through that game 5 or 6 times in the space of like 4 years.
Yeah.
Because I felt like even if I wasn't, I felt like I was missing something. And it was such a compelling world at the time.
It still is.
I'm going to go and explore it again. Like, I can remember so many locations from that game.
So here's a question then. What was your... Like, were you a sniper rifle guy, tranquilizer crossbow guy, blow the door? Okay,
sneak around and
living in the air vents.
Living in the air vents and like because it just has that tension.
Yeah.
And then if you screw up, you're probably going to die because you got caught and you don't have
weapons.
Don't have actual weapons exactly. Yeah. But it's incredibly satisfying when when you're just like walking around and you've literally taken out like every goon. And there's just bodies.
None the wiser.
Right. Yep. Exactly. And of course, those were also the days when I had time to play video games, so I could afford to be patient.
I know.
Now I'm like...
Florence, 1 hour, I'm in.
Now I'm more shooty than I used to be because it's quicker.
Yeah.
But that was the game that really like opened my eyes as to like, wow, this is like what games really could be.
And very memorable hook from our friend
Alex Brandon, yes. Yeah, I mean, the score is amazing too. It's just a game that if people usually ask me like what's your favorite game ever, that's probably like what I'm going to jump to because I just have so many great memories. And I think one of the things I'm looking forward even now when I'm playing games like because we're in the open world era of games, like these massive games, but what I want when I'm playing, I want memories. Like, and I with all of the content being thrown at us, I'm like, yeah, it's amazing, but what am I going to remember from this experience? Because it's all very well playing something for 60 hours, but what is the point of that 60 hours if you can't, like, to coin the phrase that you said earlier, if you can't take something with you?
I mean, I get that the idea of a more open world game is that the player will hypothetically find themselves in a situation where they inadvertently or intentionally kind of create that themselves.
Yeah.
And there's definitely something to that. And God knows, you know, I mean, I was huge into EverQuest about that same time as Deus Ex and had those moments. I still remember certain moments as if it was like a real, you know, visceral moment. But I'm with you.
There's a subtle, I think,
where I go.
I think you can have both. But I think some people, and it depends on what mood you're in, you want either something that is handcrafted for you or handcrafted by you.
Right.
But you might not want both of those. And you might be in the mood one day for Hellblade, which is definitely handcrafted for you.
Right, of course.
And then you might be in the mood for Destiny or something like that, which is, you know, mostly that's player agency right there. But There's kind of two different things. And I don't think there's been the game yet which has blended those two things yet with the
I mean the sheer volume of content needed. I mean, you obviously have Skyrim and things that or Horizon Zero Dawn that
those
just throw as much as possible into it, but which is, you know, circling back to music, those kinds of things pose such insane challenges. Because to me it's all, I don't like systems driven scores. I like bespoke crafted.
Right, you want to score every cutscene for Mass Effect. I think we had this conversation like a couple of years ago. Like, I want to do every cutscene and have its own like ebb and flow.
Yeah, you need as big a budget for the score as the entire rest of the game combined. Because you're like, well, look, if you have 90 hours of gameplay, obviously you need 90 hours of music. I mean, that's just intuitive. I just need 25 years and about $15 million.
Yes. And then we got it in the can.
And yeah, and we're good. No, I agree. Mass Effect is always my go-to of like, it's the Kobayashi Maru of game scoring, because it is truly unwinnable. You have a game that's niche enough that they couldn't possibly justify the budget to green light the production assets. Yep. But then it's so sprawlingly gigantic that and with such rich world building that it's like, I can't stand the fact that every time I go back to the Citadel, it's the same fucking queue. But what else are they going to do? Like, right. they're boxed in, you know? I mean, there's already hours of music in there as it is. So going back then, tell us about ModDB and your whole amazing tale there.
So, yeah. Thomas Mahler, the director of Ori, I don't know what he was doing on ModDB, but here's one thing about Thomas and the studio at Moon. They're really, really good at recruiting and looking in the deepest, darkest places on the internet for talent.
You're all beyond recruited off station. Of 4chan.
Right.
they will go anywhere.
Thomas will go anywhere to
I guess going on 4chan is like the equivalent of finding your pilot in the Mos Eisley Cantina. So,
exactly.
You know.
Yes. So, yeah, I had a profile on ModDB. Basically, when I left USC, I mean, I put my music, like, on God knows what website. Like, I was just like, if I put it somewhere, someone might listen. You just never know. Kind of throw a dart and see what sticks. It's as valid a strategy as any.
And yet, amazingly, so few composers do that. They either think, the world's just going to find me. I'm going to make my website. Like, they don't realize, like, when I'm fresh out of school, austinwintory.com is the lowest value URL on all of the internet. Like, right. It's just, but I think a lot of people think, well, I went through all this education. Doesn't the world see?
If I make a Twitter account, people will just follow me, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Build it and they will come just by default. Yeah. So this, I'm always encouraging everyone, you know, just be unapologetically everywhere that you can. And engage and talk to people. And
so I was pretty active on ModDB. I quite like enjoyed the idea of the website. It's, you know, it's where people either between jobs or like in their spare time would, you know, go to create mods for games. And so I stuck some of my music up there. And then the piece that Thomas liked was a piece from a 4-minute student film that I did at USC.
Wow.
And it's like this super ambient thing. I mean, there's literally like just, there's a pad, there's a pulse, a piano, and a plucked thing. And that's about it.
Your magnum opus.
Yeah, pretty much. He contacted me literally out of the blue and said, hey, I've got this game. I like your stuff. And we've got a prototype of this game. Would you like to play it? And I was like, okay.
And had you done any games? I mean, I know that some stuff came out before Ori, like you said, smaller indie stuff, but had you actually done them yet at this point?
At the time, I was working on Primal Carnage, but it wasn't finished.
And was that the first one?
There was In Momentum was officially the first one, and I was also kind of working on that, but these kind of like all happened at the same time.
Yeah, I understand.
But there's a little bit of overlap, but I hadn't finished
the
game.
But the process and kind of the workflow and all that.
I had zero experience, yes. Yeah,
but it wasn't 100% Alien either.
No, I did do a couple of student games as well at USC, but it was like a couple of tracks basically.
Yeah, yeah.
Not a full score.
Sure.
So anyway, he sent me the prototype, and being a gamer, like I play a game and I can tell within 10 minutes if I'm going to like the controls, how it feels. I can tell if like love has been put into it. I think anyone who's played games, you kind of just know when you're in safe hands, like when you start the game. It is rare for a game to start off really well and then just like completely lose it. It does happen because budgets and deadlines and whatever, but I played the prototype of Ori, which, by the way, that prototype looks nothing like what the game ended up looking like because they just didn't have the time or the money.
It would be hard to imagine a ragtag team making a game that looks like that.
It was all like abstract colors and tones and shapes. It was still very colorful, but like the detail on the art just wasn't there.
Sure.
But the controls were there and the gameplay was there and the level design was there. And I played it and I was like, I'm going to do this, because they didn't have any money for me to do the prototype. But what Thomas said is like, if you do the prototype for us, I'll pitch it. Thomas had worked at Blizzard before going it alone, and he had a lot of good contacts. And he was like, I'll pitch it to various publishers. And if we are successful with a pitch, then you can do the music for the game. He kept to his word. But it was literally a random email out of nowhere from a profile that I created on a website that, in the grand scheme of things, isn't a huge website. It's not a small website, but it's not like it's...
You're the only person... I never even heard of it until I heard this story.
Well,
the
there
first
you go.
Time.
There you go. So, yeah.
I mean, you even said it's like people between jobs. And
yes, exactly.
It's like I picture the sort of second life of, you know, of like people just sitting there commiserating at a bar together. And then in walks this guy that's like the cloaked figure that says, just take a chance on this. Yep. And maybe something will happen. And then, of course, but that turned out okay.
The funny thing is, I mean, I can trace back every job I ever had to ModDB.
Well,
in games. So I actually did do it.
Even your stand-up career and all the other.
Well, every job in games, I think almost exclusively. I actually thought about this recently, and I actually drew a chart, like tracing. I did a PowerPoint slide where
have you called them and been like, I feel like I should donate money to you.
Yeah, I feel like I probably should.
They should you know, this is where if it was a university, you would, you know, endow some kind of chair or something.
But yeah, like it for whatever reason, like that's how it worked out for me, and it was just from a random email. Like the site facilitated it. It was very easy to get in touch with people, and you know, I mean, Thomas to this day still does. He looks for artists the same way. I mean, he just goes through random portfolios on ArtStation, you know, and we've one of our artists, I think, like he had zero experience in games. And Thomas, I think, just saw like he had like just four pictures on ArtStation. He was like, I'm going to do a test this guy. And he passed the test, and he's been working for us for like 3 years, maybe four. Like,
wow.
And that open-minded approach is, you know, to finding people to work on your game is, you know, is why I ended up on Ori. And, you know, it helped that I nailed the prototype, because obviously if that hadn't worked out, then I wouldn't be working on it. But
that's why I was curious to get so much kind of background, because sometimes, like when I reflect on what happened with Journey, in some ways, I think I feel so lucky because I thought I felt particularly well suited to do it because I loved what they were making so much. I thought I'm at the place in my life where this is the kind of game I would want to play.
Right.
So I became obsessed and in love with their design choices and their aesthetic choices. And it was so easy to just give it everything I had. And it seems kind of similar. Like you said, in 5 seconds, if you are responding to the controls as a kind of seasoned gamer.
Yeah.
You're going to just resonate with it more than if it's just a composer who, you know, incidentally they like his work, but he's not reacting in that way.
Well, I think one of the other things that I remember pretty early on, you know, I mean, Thomas told me about the game, and there's obviously hardly any dialogue in the game, and what dialogue there is in a universal language. So it's not something that is required to be listened to.
Right. Yeah. I want to get into the casting story as right. well, because that's another good one.
And the other thing that he specifically said, he said he loves melody, and I'm like, oh well, that's nice, especially because I felt like I felt like at that time in particular, I mean, it's still the case now, but there was like a real push for like these ambient scores that didn't say anything, like back in 2010, 2011, 2012, 2013.
Oh yeah.
I mean, there still is that push, but I feel like it's evened out a little bit now.
Well, I think in no small part because of the success of games like Ori and the rise of game music concerts where you can't perform stuff like that. I mean, you know, ambient textural music sometimes is truly the perfect choice, but it doesn't go up onto the stage. And so people see, oh wow, you know, 3,000 people show up to see this concert of all these tuneful game scores.
Right.
And you can't ignore that when starting to make your own musical decisions as a game developer, I would think.
I mean, it is literally one of the first things that Thomas said. And obviously that appealed to me. And I don't think any of the melodies I put in the prototype ended up in the final game. But it provided enough of a template to work from going forward.
Was the aesthetic generally similar?
It's very colorful, but in terms of the level of detail on the visuals, absolutely.
No,
not.
I mean musically.
Oh, sorry, musically.
Your prototype, because the score has a definite palette that it that it holds to. It's not grabbing randomly.
The score ended up being more orchestral than was in the prototype. The prototype is more, I mean, there's some strings in the prototype, but it's mostly piano, tune, percussion, and synths. A lot of pads, because that's what I felt was appropriate. Because
the piano is still really important in the score.
Yes, the piano is super important. I mean, everyone on the team, like whenever I do something, even for the new game, whenever something like comes in with the piano, it's like, we love the piano.
Is that encouragement from them more than it's your own?
I think
fixation.
I mean, now I'm like kind of bound to the DNA of the first game.
Of course.
Like I'll try and push it in new directions, but every so often there's like, you know, there's a time when you need to kind of bring it out. But fortunately, with the number of different environments in the game and the way the game makes each environment look so different, that's enough for me to push the palette elsewhere as well. The piano, and I've said this before, like the piano and the orchestra is kind of the glue that kind of binds everything else together. But it always amuses me when people say that Ori is an orchestral score. But like, and you probably like
same with Journey. There's like 20 minutes of orchestra,
right? Like, it's like
huge amounts of pads.
Yes, exactly. It's like there's pads, and I'm like always telling people, like, if you listen really carefully, of course it's the stuff that we obsess about that no one really cares. Like,
yeah.
But I'm like, if you listen really carefully, there's this like always this gentle pulsing in the game, because I kind of want to push the player forward, and it's a platformer, and Ori's little footsteps are always being heard, and literally in every gameplay cue there is some kind of like bubbling ostinato in the background, whether it's in tuned percussion or a plucked instrument. Even actually in the wind area, it's a bansuri ostinato just in the background. Like there's always something in the background, but no one actually hears that. They just hear like soaring strings.
Yeah, exactly. Back to our earlier thing. People remember the really iconic moments.
Yes.
So it's like, and all those more subtle things are important because they're the runway to that.
Exactly.
You're priming people. Because I think if you come in and you smack people out of nowhere, it's just not as memorable than when the temperature is rising and kind of producing that anticipation of something to come. It's very rare that you can just sort of drop. I mean, I think of like the opening of Up. And even then, it still has a shape. There's still an arc just within those 10 minutes or whatever. So, to me, that's what the art of storytelling even is. It's all about that shape and that arc. So as much as no one maybe emails you to ask about, you know, that synth pulse during that one quiet moment, they wouldn't be emailing you otherwise.
It was needed to make that moment.
Absolutely.
And my favorite...
Did you find that out as part of the process? Because this was years of your life. So was that a discovery, or did you feel like, I know what this needs, and it was just about execution all that time?
So I think I really started to understand what the game needs, and it's the most famous sequence from the game. But it's not just the water chase sequence. It's everything that leads up to before that. So once you're inside the Ginza, once you enter the Ginza Tree right at the bottom, like it's very linear. Like it's kind of it's the end of Act One. That whole sequence from like when you enter the Ginza Tree, then you do the chase, then you have the cutscene on top where you're introduced to Kuro for the first time, and then Ori falls down, and then Ori wakes up in the swamp. Which has now got clean water because you've saved the Ginza Tree, which is the source of water in the forest. That to me was when I realized that was one big sequence rather than just like, here's level one of the Ginza Tree, level two of the Ginza Tree, then we have the boss fight, and then we have the cutscene. I think there's always a danger in game scoring where you score stuff in a vacuum. That was the That actually finishing that was the moment where I was like, I think I understand. I'm not going to say I understand game music, but like, I now feel like I know what I'm doing.
It was
the turning point for me on the score.
How far in would you say that was?
That happened in July 2014, 5 months before recording. So
you spent most of the time waffling aimlessly with no clue what you were doing.
Had the themes. had the themes. That was like, that helped. And we had some environment music, but that was like when it truly clicked. Like everything after that happened so fast. Like I knew how to do all of the other levels.
Wow. So this was a really exponential.
Yes.
Like it was years of a slow burn followed by incomprehensible stress and anxiety.
And I kind of like that, though. I kind of don't mind the slow burn. Like I now know how I work.
Yeah.
And hitting the accelerator button at the end and timing it to peak, it's a little bit risky, especially when dates move. But
did that happen on Ori?
Yes. Like, oh yeah, we moved the recording twice on Ori as well. And the game, I think the game was originally scheduled to come out like a year and a half earlier than it did. I can't remember.
It's a very normal game then.
Yes, exactly. But you know, it's all good.
Now, was the budget for the orchestra and the overall kind of production finesse, was that built in once they had their publishing deal, or was that something that was in flux and you didn't know?
It was established at the beginning, and it was immovable. So I think...
For them, you mean?
For them, yes.
Oh, that's nice. So they like melody and they won't get rid of their orchestra budget.
I think it was a conversation briefly when the game got delayed and they were like, well, we're not going to get extra money for the game, but the orchestra didn't get cut. So
five people lost their jobs so that you could go to Nashville.
No one lost their jobs. I think they just banked. If anyone lost their jobs, I think Thomas and Gennady just didn't pay themselves.
Yeah.
It ended up working out. But yeah, that moment, like when I figured out that the Ginzo Tree was like one, I don't want to call it a symphony because it's not that, but it's like one suite of music. And it's actually made up of about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, about 8 different cues from like the bottom of the tree to the very end when you wake up in the swamp.
All under the hood. In other words, your epiphany was that the player would perceive it as one unfolding moment and not interlocking sequences
Ideally you'll never divided. Hear and actually I don't think you do you never hear the transitions between one cue and another, because we didn't have any middleware on Ori.
Really? Like directly in Engine,
it's
or
directly in Unity, which is a
wow. You must have taken it to the absolute breaking point of what it can do.
We had very very good programmers who were like, and I guess I wrote the stuff up in my PDFs clearly about what I wanted. But the other thing is you never really hear the transitions because they're almost always covered up by sound effects.
You're right. Yeah. It's a noisy sequence.
Even before that, like when you're opening doors, like when a door opens, change the music. When you pull a switch, change the music. Like I'm looking.
It's the same in a movie. Like you come in under the gunshot the door slamming shot.
Every time, I mean, even with the game now, I'm like looking for those moments, because when you have music all the time, it's like, well, where can I change it? And Ori is wall to wall. It's part of the DNA of the game. We're not making the kind of game which doesn't have. It would be a very different game. It would feel very different, and you could make it that way. Like if we made it like Inside or something.
Yeah, exactly.
But we're not making that game. It's
I hope on Mod DB somewhere. Someone is making the Playdead style Ori remaster. That's just horrendously depressing.
More depressing than the first
than
act.
Than
especially.
It is anyway. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's just all like muddled color.
Right.
Not that there's any real disparity between those two in terms of difficulty.
Right.
I don't think I always love using Ori as an example for people when talking about true victories in game design, and that the controls and also just the kind of gameplay death respawn loop is so satisfying, because to me punishing really hard games
with a long
loading time
to make you think about how bad you lose.
Yes, so I'm
looking
like
at Bloodborne.
Yes, or to me Cuphead was the real because I was one of those. I loved so much, overwhelmingly everything about it, and yet it was so fucking hard. And the fact that you have to wait more than 4 seconds.
Yes.
And I got a pretty stacked gaming PC, and I still was just like fuming with rage at all my failure in life. And it was like, you start going to this mode and you're like, I'm probably not good to the people that I care about, and I could be a better boyfriend. And then it's like, you start going places and you're like, I think this game is turning me into a,
here's where I can like show my
youngling Anakin.
I can show my nerddom, because you mentioned Cuphead, and I A-plussed the hole.
God damn it. This interview is over.
I love that. So for me, that game to me is just pattern recognition. And
well, yeah, absolutely.
Like, so easy mode is no more difficult than medium to me.
Because it's just the Rain Man of
platformers. It's just a different pattern to me. Now, I haven't tried hard mode, but it probably just requires more controller dexterity once I see the patterns.
Did you ever play Super Hexagon?
I have not. I have it, but I have not played it.
Well, let's talk after you've suffered through that for a little while. Because it also is purely pattern recognition. Yeah. And I watched Terry Cavanaugh, the creator, play it at an event once in front of an audience to showcase the game. And it was like watching Data on Next Gen, where his hands are all blurry.
If you've ever been, I lived in Japan, and like those people playing the Beat Mania games or like the pop and music, just like,
it's not
they're
human.
Just like moving, again, I'm moving my hands on a podcast, but they're moving their hands so quickly. And I'm just like, you've just learned it. It's just muscle memory at this point.
But and then still it's still mind-blowing.
Oh, it's like, I'm like, you look like an octopus right now. But
you are definitely
it's fun to watch.
Altering the fabric of reality. Actually, let's get back to Japan quickly, because I realized I meant to get into that a little bit. And I'm also curious because, especially within the world of JRPGs, there's a definite aesthetic you can hear in the Japanese composers.
Yes.
Like there's a kind of a little bit of a shared language, even as much as someone like, you know, Uematsu is different from Yoko Kanno or somebody like that, and you can really hear their individual personalities. There also appears to be a kind of distinctly Japanese aesthetic to the handling of the orchestra, and I've always felt like I can hear traces of that in your writing, and I wasn't sure if that was my imagination, especially in Ori and especially during the kind of action climactic sequences.
Yeah.
And so am I crazy or too... there is no one. It's only two. I'm not crazy. Tell me why I'm right.
I think when you live in a country, there's always going to be a process of osmosis. Like you're going.
How old were you?
22, 25. I left the Royal Academy of Music.
It's 3 years.
Oh yeah. I was like, I'm going to go and teach English. That's what I did. I did do a little bit of composition, but I wasn't working in music.
Was that just wanderlust, or was that like, I don't know what else I'm going to do, or?
I don't know what I'm going to do. I didn't know at the time, if music was going to be, first of all, if I was good enough. Second of all, if I really loved it. And third of all, I was like, well, if I am into music, then I'm going to need to travel now. And so Japan...
Yet another seemingly blasé, life-changing decision. It was like earlier today when I was like, do you want to do this podcast? And they're like, well, I got nothing else going on.
So I had visited Japan once before, and I really loved it. So I was like, the reason I ended up there, honestly, I was like worried about what I was going to be doing after I graduated. And I was like, jobs for graduates on Google.
On ModDB.
Not on ModDB. I didn't know about ModDB at the time. And it was like, teach English in Japan. And I was like, well, that salary looks okay. And I was like, oh, they'll pay your rent as well. And they'll pay your travel costs. And I can eat all my meals at the school. I'm like, I literally was able to save so much money. And I'm living in another country. And I'm like getting all of this culture, and I'm kind of getting paid to do it. Sounds great.
Not to mention that as a gamer, it's impossible to not basically almost fetishize Japan. I mean, anyone who grew up, they're the leaders.
Yep.
There's so many incredible games and storytelling, and like things that push the boundaries of what storytelling can even mean. And not just in games, obviously in film and animation, and there's a million. So it makes sense that it would be almost like this. You know, you're a moth to its flame.
If there was a time to do it, that was going to be the time. And then while I was there, I was like, okay, I really like music. Like I enjoyed my time there teaching English. And the thing that I always say, because people always ask me, why do you go to Japan? It has nothing to do with music. I'm like, no, it has everything to do with my career.
Yeah.
Like it has.
Well, living one's life and just engaging with novel experiences and things that stretch it. Music will always benefit from that. No, like, so there is no way to just be independent of your musical growth.
I think the biggest thing I learned there was that Japan is all about the team, all about the group. And that is exactly what we are doing. And I was there to teach English. They did not give a shit about my music. And that was probably the best thing for me at the time, because for pretty much my whole life up until then, family, friends, I was like the best musician in boarding school, like, by far. Like,
especially as a composer, you're always a rare breed. Unless you grow up in Hollywood or something, you're always like the weird novel creature that people love to trot out. Look at my genius.
Yes, exactly. And it's just like, you know, and you get a false sense of where you're really at. And Japan like brought me right back down to earth. And I was there to teach English, and the two things
not to mention the like per capita musical prodigies.
I mean, the kids there are really, really good at music, and I was like, well, I'm not even here to do that. So, but I learned not only, you know, the value of helping the group, because that is what we do. We are part of a team. We're not just, much as we like to think of ourselves in our ivory towers and, you know, composing away, we are part of a team that is, you know, telling stories. Now, I'm not telling stories while teaching English, but I still have to work with a bunch of other people. And the other thing that really helped was I was very, very shy growing up. But you can't be shy when you're teaching kids how to how to speak English, and you especially can't be shy when you are communicating with people whose language isn't your own. You have to be really clear. You have to speak.
Did you have to? How much did you absorb Japanese as part of that?
My Japanese when I left was pretty good. Listening and speaking Japanese is actually really easy because there's a limited number of phonetics. There's only 46 phonetics. Now, reading and writing is another question entirely because there's all the symbols. But you don't really need reading and writing to live.
There's a good out of context sentence.
I'm
gonna clip that one later.
You do need it, but we had a supervisor like to help us with like, you know, getting a house and like getting a phone and all of that stuff. But to your day-to-day, like listening and speaking Japanese, just getting by, it's pretty basic stuff, actually. And I did find, you know, the people, there's levels of Japanese, like levels of formality where the sentence structure gets a bit more complicated if you're speaking to someone more senior. I was never expected to know any of that. They'd always speak in the most basic childlike level.
The equivalent of the American who just gets louder as their attempts to be clearer.
But that was really helpful, to be honest. It helped me learn it quicker. And, you know, when you're in a room full of teachers, obviously they know how to speak to someone who's less experienced.
Right.
So, The two things that I ended up, you know, really enjoying. I really enjoyed teaching English, but I wasn't even teaching English. These kids knew everything. Japanese kids are really smart. They just don't have any confidence. And I felt I'm not really an English teacher. I'm more of a cheerleader. Like I have to get I would ask a kid. I would literally say, "What's your name?" And they do the classic like, Are you speaking to me? They'd like look at the kid behind them and like, wait, are you really addressing me in front of the whole class? Because that is a very difficult thing. Mm. Like, because you're not supposed to stand out. But I'm like, you guys are going to have to like learn to speak at some point, like in public. And that's what I felt like I was doing. I felt like I was being a cheerleader, facilitating the use of English rather than and just encouraging them. And eventually, like the walls would break down. One of the other things I did do there, and this is going to seem so random, I coached the rugby team.
Spectacular.
Because no one else knew how. And I was like, well... I really love rugby. It's a British sport. So... And I'm very familiar with it. I know all the rules. And I'm like, well, I'll just coach the team because no one else knows how to. And those kids, their English was amazing. like they aced every single test and their confidence was also high. And I was able to play with them because I was still like young and fit. So just doing that and like it really helped me learn the value of communication, which, you know, when you're standing in front of an orchestra and you need to communicate your ideas and you've got a limited time and the clock's ticking and the money's like disappearing down the drain and you're worried about overtime, man, you need to get your ideas across quickly and efficiently. And that's just one skill like that transferred over. I could do a whole podcast about like every skill that transferred over from my time in Japan.
But it seems like also... you know, the root of the original question was also just, it seemed like aesthetically, almost culturally, I mean, because clearly, you're going to get an enormous amount of practical world experience. Yep. Plus anyone who lives amongst people that think differently from them, there's just no way around that basically being a universal net gain. Yep. I just don't know. I've ever heard some story of someone that's like, I did an exchange program and I'm just a shithead now.
Right.
I mean,
it always benefited.
Yeah, yeah. There's just no bad version of that that I've, I mean, I'm sure there is some, someone's going to find one now and I'm going to hear about it. But broadly speaking, I can see, you know, the list of positives is going to be enormous, but it seems like the cultural infusion expressed itself professionally later.
To get to
and
yeah,
it's not, and it's truly not my imagination.
No, to get back to your aesthetic. I mean, I think, you know, I actually came to the let's start with the Ghibli Studio Ghibli movies. I actually came to them really late. I did not discover them. I had only watched Spirited Away before I arrived in Japan, and then
I'm amazed they let you in.
Right, exactly.
there's just basic knowledge required.
And then my students were like, have you seen blah blah blah, have you seen blah blah? I'm like, well, there's my homework, you know, that like, and in fact it became a thing, like in my second and third year I was like, I'm gonna give you guys something to do like in English, but I want you guys to give me something, and then we'll talk about it next week in class. So it would be a new film or a new anime. I'm not really into anime, but I was like, I'm gonna do it. And although when you ask, I was teaching in a boys' school, and when you ask boys to like recommend an anime, you get into the, yeah, you can imagine.
We get into podcast after dark.
After dark, yes, exactly.
yeah, I'm sure.
But, you know, and then you get exposed to the music and it's like, oh, well, literally all of Joe Hisaishi's music is really, really good and does have a very specific sound. And it's funny you mentioned like the common language. I'm like, there's so many jazz chords, like sneaking, there's so many sevenths and ninths. And I'm just like, man, that is pretty indulgent, but it kind of works.
I mean, even, you know, listening to like the Final Fantasy scores, you know, growing up, and that I always thought like no one ever labels this jazz, but it is practically just orchestral jazz.
Yeah. Those Final Fantasy, especially the recent ones, I'm like, we have some jazz fusion now. And then we've got like an opera track, and then there's like a random rock track. And I'm like, well, okay.
Sometimes it goes too far for me. I feel that, but it is.
But the earliest,
most...
I know where you're coming from. Like the earliest stuff, especially like 7, 8, 9, and even 10. Like those soundtracks. Like the language is very consistent and the style is pretty consistent. But like the amount of jazz harmony that's in there, or rich Ravelian chords, I would say. And it does kind of like peak up in like other Japanese media too.
Yeah, and I felt that was a, again, it's not that your music sounded or sounds like that, as if this was all you know.
Right.
But I remember while playing, because I never listened to the score to Ori other than little bits and pieces, but I played it pretty soon after it came out. And I just remember thinking, like, this, I can feel the hallmarks of an influence here. I wasn't sure if it was a conscientious, like, that's how I want to kind of stylize the score, if it was just kind of baked into your DNA as a composer.
It's definitely baked into the DNA. I definitely wasn't thinking about it. I think a lot of the stuff I write is I'm not really trying to sound like something else. I generally, and it sometimes doesn't work out, I generally ignore the temp completely. There wasn't any temp for Ori, which was nice.
I mean, you were in there from the beginning.
Yeah, so... The music I write, you know, now is very different to what if I did Ori now, it would probably be a little bit different to what I did 5 years. And I guess we're going to find out in when the new game comes out, like it's not going to be wildly different, but like, you know, we change as people. It's been 4.5 years since Ori came out, and, you know, 7.5 years since I started working on the project. People change and styles change, and, you know, I've lived in America, so maybe my school will sound more American.
Yes, exactly.
I'm eligible to
all become homegrown hot dog
right,
music now.
Right, exactly.
I'm eligible pies, all that.
I'm eligible to become an American next month. So maybe it'll be a truly American school.
At which point you will immediately move back to Japan.
Right. But I think I never set out to like try and emulate anything. I think scores that are the result of a process of osmosis are actually really interesting, because like if that's what you hear, then that's really cool to me. But like I think I put out a tweet recently, or retweeted someone that said someone compared Ori and the Matrix soundtrack. And I'm just like...
Yeah, that's bizarre.
And I'm just like...
The Matrix, known for all of its great melodies and...
My publicist followed up with the journalist, and the journalist is actually going to like forward me like the specific references.
It's going to be like one chord.
But that, I'm like, hey,
they're going to go, it's all that background pulsing.
Right. Right. But I'm like, that person heard what they wanted to hear. And you know, if that, that's cool to me.
I've certainly been on the receiving end of, of those kinds of where you just go,
how did you hear that?
Yeah. Not even how, as if it's something hidden, but just like where... That makes no sense whatsoever.
But I'm like, hey, I'm going to retweet that because Ori and the Matrix, whatever, sure.
Yeah, no, for sure. Well, so, I mean, we could, there's a lot I want to hit on. I'm going to see if I can kind of lightning around this. I think there's a funny story. I'll bring myself into the narrative a little bit because I'll never forget. I had heard Who You Are simply because the extended network of USC grads is relatively small. And especially since you were, I think, only 1 or 2 years after me, and I had a better sense of who the recent grads were when I was myself basically a recent grad. And so I knew your name, and we were probably friends on Facebook, but I didn't know you. And then one day you called me out of the blue and said that you were looking for a mixer referral because you were working on this game. And I'll never forget, you said, look, I've made a career, I'm paraphrasing you here, because I'm realizing I probably sound like an ass, so I'll make clear this isn't exactly how you said it, but I'm just going to double down. So you're like, oh, so I've been working a lot, but it's all trailers, and I'm kind of above that, you know? Now, you said, I'm used to mixing things myself, normally as a function of budget, but I have a little bit of money, and it just seems like that would be a reasonable thing to spend money on. What are your thoughts? And I had been working with this mixer who I just adored, who... You know, my team is a combination of people, you know, about my same age who I think of, you know, we're like riding, you know, like shotgun relative to each other in our careers, where you want to have one of these 50-year spans, hopefully, together. But then I also wanted to surround myself with people that had been working as long as I've been alive, and I could learn from them. And Steve Kempster was one of those people. You know, when I was in middle school, he was like mixing Armageddon. Or in high school or whatever it was. And so like this guy had been around the block on some of the biggest, most high pressure films. And he had such a strong musical sensibility. We just met at a party and I needed a mixer for someone for something and tried him out. We got along amazingly and loved doing sessions together, loved doing mixes. So I was super happy. And a lot of his film clients had kind of stopped working. So I was like, oh, I love the idea of him, you know, having kind of, multiple games under his hat. So I was super stoked to refer. And it obviously worked out great. He mixed Ori sounds super amazing. And then the funniest thing, you very graciously give a special thanks to me in the end credits. And it has never failed to amaze me how many people messaged me to go, oh my God, I heard you did the music for Ori and the Blind. And I was like, what the fuck?
It's funny because there's literally music by. There's like a giant music department. And it's like.
You have to ignore an hour of credits before you get to the bottom of the special thanks. I'm like, who's even still watching by that point?
Right.
The most hilarious. But I was like, I guess I get it because like we both use strings, therefore we're clones.
Right, exactly.
Anyway, it was very funny. I kept saying, but it was a joyous moment because I was like, look, I'm thrilled you love the score. It's all this guy. This guy wrote the shit out of this thing. I mean, it's just spectacular. So anyway, I love, and it makes me so happy that now I have the damnedest time getting on Steve's calendar because he's constantly doing shit with you. And so that makes me really, really happy that two talented people managed to hit it off to that extent.
Well, I mean, like, I mean, I was in a bind at that point because for Ori, I was doing everything, and it was partly a budget concern. And, you know, I do have a, much like you, I have a team, like, and I had a team out there to help me with the recording, but I didn't have anyone helping me with orchestration.
Right.
I did all the notation. I did all the parts.
Yep.
And never again. I'd never done that before.
Right.
I'd never run a session for a score. Like, and there I was. I mean, we arrived in Nashville. I was still preparing parts, and no one could help me because I was the only one that I hadn't. It was too late for delegation.
Yeah, exactly.
So I was like, well, there's only one way this is getting done, and it's me staying up all night. Alex, my conductor, and Zach, like, is my second set of ears. They just went to the bar because what else were they going to do? And it's Nashville, so
no shortage of bars.
But there was me, and I was like, and then the ultimate metaphor came up because it was like there was a massive thunderstorm, like the night before the recording,
and you realized, oh, the thunderstorm is all one cue,
right?
get it now.
But like, I was doing everything and I was like, I'm not going to be able to mix as well. Like, I mean, I probably could have and it would have been fine. But like, just being able to like, not switch off completely, but just like take a step away from the project.
Well, and let someone hear it who doesn't have years worth of all this built up bullshit that biases like, oh no, that little third note in the middle of the chord is everything. And if I lose, and they're like, no, this is what counts here.
And I knew I was, you hit on that really well. Like it's, I was kind of aware that that would be a problem. And I was like, I just need to, you know, let someone else do it. And it was actually the first time I'd ever actually let someone else be a part of my musical process other than the conducting.
Right.
So it was that was new to me, but like, what I was worried about was like, I put everything into that score and, you know, if Ori hadn't being successful, I don't know what would have happened afterwards. There's an alternate universe where Ori isn't successful and I'm back in Japan teaching English, probably. Like,
no, I totally get it. I have no idea.
Everything riding on it. Like,
yeah. Well, that's the thing. And it's another lesson for students or people getting in. Like, you know, I tend to believe you should approach every project because you just don't know. I mean, in the case of Journey, I remember thinking we made the game we set out to make, but it's so different from the so-called mainstream that I don't know if anyone's going to embrace it, but still put everything into it as if they are or as if they might and just hope for the best. And
there's also a timing thing as well. Like, you know, had Ori released a year earlier or a year later, would it have captured the imagination? I'm sure it's the same with Journey well. Like,
if Journey
like,
came out today, I don't think it would have the same, even close to reaction.
It's a different industry. But sometimes, like, a beautiful set of circumstances just like contrives to happen. And it definitely happened with Journey and it happened with Ori as well. Like, and yeah, fortunately it took off, but like I had everything riding on it and I was like, and to be fair, like the whole of Moon Studios did as well. It's like, you know, if this game tanks, but you know, it's back to corporate jobs.
Back to ModDB for all of us.
Right. Exactly. So yeah, I mean, the pressure was not exclusive to me. It was so like having,
I actually respond well to that when I'm on a project and you feel everybody just giving everything.
Yes,
it's like you care so much because you're like, I don't want to be the weak link in this chain now.
That's those amazing times when you know everyone's like, press the accelerator button. Like, it's time to ship. like, you know, we're with that on the, you know, on the second game. It's time to ship, and like, you know, the accelerator button is all the way to the floor. Because there's a lot of like figuring stuff out, but then, you know, oh, we could add this and we could add that. Oh, that's a cool monster. Let's add that. That's a cool ability. And then it's like, yeah, we got to finish the game.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
now it's time to cut and cut and cut. And that, you know, the once you make those cuts and then everyone like knows what the game is, knows what you have to do to finish, and then everyone's moving in the same direction, it's kind of cool to get that acceleration. So I'm with you. Like the pressure, it's both. I think on Ori, it was the first time for me like I'd ever felt that kind of pressure, so it was like a bit scary. Now I kind of have been through the ringer once. I kind of know what to expect. It's a little bit easier to handle, and it is very cool when everyone's like on the same wavelength at the end. There's a special kind of synergy that happens in the teams that are really tight and have good leadership and know what the final destination is.
Well, it's lucky though, because sometimes sequels suffer because, you know, the all the magic came together on the first one.
Yep.
And then something about those circumstances turned out to be the reason why.
Yep.
People are in different places in their life. Some people leave and their chemistry is now missing. And it's not uncommon that sequels just don't have that spark even close. Yep. So it's nice to hear that you're feeling so good about it.
Well, I mean, it's one of there was some turnover after Ori 1. Because people got offered jobs. It's inevitable.
Well,
but
Well, let me stop you because I want to lightning round some things.
Oh, okay. Go for it.
especially because you also were someone who was offered jobs, and there's been a proliferation of Gareth Coker work in the post-Ori world. One that we could easily talk about, but I'll let people go listen to the annotator of the Ark Survival Evolved score. I love it, and it's a great testimony to your thematic writing, because there are times where I'm sitting here and I'm trying to do something and the back of my head is going na, 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 and I'm like, God damn it, leave me alone. So really, really great score, people should go check out. One I want to ask you about, because it's also great and I know nothing about it, and okay, it's a good chance that people don't know either, is Mean Greens, because it is the most infectiously fun thing ever musically. And that struck me as one of those where I thought, this is a small game that you're injecting an enormous amount of life into, where you have a shot at really raising the production to a whole new level. And so just, you know, we don't need to get too far into it, but I just want to know a little bit about that, because it's one of those that I just love.
So Mean Greens was the second game from the guy who made Primal Carnage. He's like, I want to make this fun, wacky shooter with the army soldiers. And I was like, that sounds...
The classic toy soldiers on the little stand.
And I was like, that sounds absolutely wild. And I was like, well, what kind of music do you want for it? And he referenced all of this Pixar and Disney stuff. And I'm like... that's going to sound terrible if we do it like just in the box. And
when in like specifically the kind of Randy Newman, big bandies thing. Yeah. That's what,
And I was like, wow, if I'm going to do this properly, I need to get it recorded. but this is like the lowest of low budget games. I talked to the game director and we came up with a deal where I would get paid on the back end based on the game's sales. I was like, okay, I did the math and I was like, then I contacted...
How many units equals...
Yes, exactly. And I was like, okay, well, if that seems like a realistic target. And then I was like, okay, well, let's see how quickly we can get this recorded. By this time, I'd done a couple of sessions with Alex and Zach, and our chemistry, especially in the Nashville players, because we've recorded them so much, is exceptional. Like, we're fast anyway, but, like, we're really fast with them, and we just kind of know, like, how... It's kind of a telepathic thing at this point. I'm sure you have the same thing with your crew.
That's why you stick with them.
We recorded the entire score for Mean Greens in 4 hours of recording time, which is really stupid. But like, it's literally because it's 60 players. Like, it's... and that score really has no... that game does not have the budget for 60 live players. But I was like, whatever. Ori's just come out. Things are looking a bit better. I'm probably going to be okay.
This is where you're stupid. Yeah. Most people go develop like a Coke habit or whatever, and you're like, I know, 60 players
yes,
on Mean
exactly.
Greens.
But I was like, you know what? You only live once. Like, what? I get a chance. I'm pretty sure like the chances of me getting to even write like this again are going to be quite rare, because really a style of music that is asked for very much, and it's completely off. One of the tracks is literally called Off the Rails. I mean, the whole game is off the rails. It's bonkers.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the levels takes place in a bathtub and there's rubber ducks going around. It's Capture the Flag. Like, it's I did a take on Ride of the Valkyries for the music. Like, it's Ride of the Valkyries crossed with Pirates of the Caribbean. I mean, it's deliberately paying homage to all... It definitely references a lot of stuff, but I was like, this is just fun. This is like what I... It's actually what I needed coming out of something that I'd invested a lot of time into. This is actually a really quick turnaround. We recorded Mean Greens in like July 2016, I think. I think that's right. July 2016, and then it was out in like December 2016. So I'd had a year out like from Ori, and you know, I was still doing like the little DLC for Ori, but that was only like 15 minutes of music.
Right.
So this was like a nice thing to jump into. It's like 11 or 12 tracks, and it's just a completely different style of game.
It makes me happy. It was just one of those that, you know, because sometimes there are people that are, you know, in our world are effectively kind of one-hit wonders. And that's true for developers and for animators, any field can potentially have someone that just gets lucky, strikes gold, yep. and then somehow just never, they kind of just disappear after yep. that. And you always wonder, like, I wonder how they're paying rent now and right. stuff. Because especially if they really did something extraordinary. And so it has made me happy. Obviously, you've collaborated a lot on the Minecraft franchise yes. and worked with Insomniac yep. to bring it to the home of this podcast with Ted. Obviously, the next Ori is coming soon. By the time this is audible to people, I'm betting it will still not be out, but never underestimate the evil, nefarious Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences and keeping us under wraps here. You can't hold us down! Yes, we will avoid spoilers. I know that you're one-upping everywhere you can on the next one. I'm sure it's going to be really exciting. One last thing I just want to hear your reflection on is, because you tapped on something that is always wonderful to hear about. You mentioned this concert in Poland that you did last year. Where they gave, it was a whole concert of your music, and you were sharing the festival with Peter McConnell, who is one of both of our, I literally have the Grim Fandango vinyl sitting about 4 feet away from us right now. Like that childhood heroes of both of ours. And certainly speaking for myself, becoming friends with him is one of those surreal windfalls of my career going, okay, because I think I've practically worshiped this guy for like 20 years and now I get to call him a friend, and that's utterly surreal. And so similarly, you know, seeing his music celebrated in this way and then having your own, you know, side by side, just give us a sense of what that was like and how it felt. And also hearing music that was written to come, you know, in overly reductive terms, to come out of little speakers in someone's room or in their headphones yeah. somewhere, up on stage in a grand scale in front yeah. of hundreds or thousands of people.
So it's funny because that concert, like I just didn't know what to expect going in. Ori's
it was the first of it's worth mentioning yes, also yep. this was a big gamble on their part yes. as well, because they had launched this whole new kind of concert.
brand new event completely. And Ori had been performed, there's a suite of Ori that, you know, has popped up here and there, but never a whole concert, just partially because the arranging work is, it's no small task, because what we talked about earlier, there's a lot of other stuff that yeah. needs to be, that isn't like a traditional part of the orchestra that needs to be adapted.
Well, and not just, never mind the fact that, like, for example, you know, you said your big climactic moment, that's actually, you know, almost a dozen cues all interwoven. Yes, exactly. They're not on the page
right.
in a way that you could sensibly input it. And people don't, I think, understand
yeah,
that.
Yeah, you can't just take the music from the recording session and slap it. I wish it was that simple, but it's just not.
Not even close.
So anyway, I got asked to do the festival in Poland, and I'm like, where is this place? I've never heard of this city at all. Like, yeah. And then you look at how it's spelled. It's spelled Wroclaw. I'm like, Wroclaw. And I'm like, nope, the pronunciation of that is Wroclaw. And I'm like, it looks nothing like that. And I was like, I don't know anything about this city. I'm going to this place that's in the middle of nowhere in Poland. I'm like, I'm going to be staying in a, you know, in some awful place. I had the stereotypical. Yes, I had the stereotypical impression of what it would be like to stay in Poland.
It's all black and white as soon
yeah,
as you get off.
Pretty much, yeah. I have to be honest, I had low expectations. And I actually told them this in my feedback. Like the festival like just blew away my expectations completely.
And always I guess, easy when you go in expecting absolute horrors.
Yes, exactly.
I heard it was truly, by any measure, an incredible
it was an unbelievable experience. I mean, I've never felt more welcomed in at any event, and I've you know,
including this recording,
right? Exactly. Sorry you don't,
it's a hostile, very gotcha environment.
You need to be offering me 18 shots of their flavored vodka to like
I gave you the ass cap.
You did
whiskey.
Have the whiskey, yes.
Yeah. Just can't please you.
You know, I got off plane. They took me straight to rehearsals. Like, I'm like, I need to sleep, but nope, you're going straight to rehearsals. I'm like, well, that's actually kind of cool. That'll keep my adrenaline going until I need to sleep. But like, they had everything laid out for us. And then the actual events themselves, there was Heroes of Might and Magic, Ori, Grim Fandango, and Warcraft, Starcraft, like Blizzard extravaganza.
Yeah, Symphony of the Storm.
Yeah. The quality of production, I was like, I was totally blown away because I was like, first of all, this concert hall, I was like, what is this doing in this city? This is not even in Warsaw or Krakow. It's in Wrocław. It's the third biggest city. It's like, what are the concert halls like in the biggest city in Poland and the capital? It's just an incredible
world
facility.
Class, as it turns
right,
out.
Exactly. And I was like, wow, this is what it's like here. And then, yeah, as you say, it's like hear your music come to life. It was the first time I'd been able to like just sit in the audience and like actually... I mean, I didn't listen to my own soundtracks very much at all because all I hear is mistakes. I think that's pretty common. But I was like, this is kind of cool. Like, you know, I get to hear my own music and it's slightly different, obviously, because it's not how it plays back in the game. And, you know, I'm not a conductor. Like, I can conduct, but I choose not to. It's not really my deal. But I did do a premiere from one of the cues from Will of the Wisps, which I did conduct at the end. And that was also super cool. And I felt like I actually knew the music, even because I was like, if they'd asked me to conduct Ori, I've like forgotten half of it.
Yeah.
I've written a little bit of music since I finished Ori.
Exactly.
And yeah, I remember like at the after party of the event, like because Peter brought his family, like he made it a family event, and like and his family had the most amazing time. We were just like talking about it and like how it was the most cool event that either of us had really ever been to, that was just there to celebrate game music, and now you get to have that experience this year.
I'm looking forward to it. I
was
very emboldened to you know when they reached out,
yep,
because I had seen your glowing Facebook post and you know brand new profile photo in front of the orchestra. I was like,
yeah,
I'm in.
You'll get some great photos as well. Like, I mean, they really did everything. They just did everything right. Like, it's different. You'll understand exactly what I mean when you go over there this year. But like, yeah, I think it's you, and then they're doing Shadow of the Colossus and all of the related games, and then the Jesper
Kidd.
Like
a Last Guardian, Shadow of Colossus,
right.
Ico kind of hybrid show.
It's just another ridiculously heavyweight lineup, and I think now that they got the first year done, and I know the event was profitable, hopefully they can get more people to the second one, because I think the biggest challenge they have is getting people to this seemingly random city in Poland, because that's what everyone's attitude is going to be who doesn't live there. With you and Jesper and Takeshi there for this year, like the fact that you guys are also willing to go.
It's funny, he actually
really
emailed
helps.
Me, TK, the composer of The Last Guardian, emailed to say, hey, I was invited to this thing and I see you're doing it, so what do you know? And I was like, Gareth loved it. That was about all I had to say.
Yeah.
And Neil loved it.
I'll be shocked if you don't love it.
Oh, I'm sure I will.
Prepare your stomach for the vodka.
Noted. Noted.
Poland has this selection of vodka, the 18 different flavors. I think there might be 21 now. And I managed to sample every single one while I was there. So.
Just prior to jumping on stage.
Yeah, pretty much.
Well, there's so much more we could get into.
Yes.
We're already in like hour 7,
yeah.
So I should wrap this up. But thank you so much for agreeing to do this and retread some older stories that I imagine you've told a lot, but which are just
so
awesome.
There was some new stuff that was not covered. I hope it was interesting for the audience as well.
I'm sure. Well, we're going to edit to ensure. And if it's...
right.
Like
Robo
Voice.
It'll be 2 minutes long.
Tell us how people can find you, social media, websites, that kind of thing.
Website is just my name, GarethCoker.net. Easiest way to get in touch with me is on Twitter. And I'm reasonably active on Twitter.
Yeah.
And my Twitter handle is just my name, Gareth Coker.
Beautiful. Well, we'll come stalk you in droves. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for the Game Maker's Notebook. For more information on the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences, our podcasts, and our other initiatives, please visit www.interactive.org.